I listen to the diaries because it sparks ideas for new adventures. Whether it is an episode about an epic adventure or a backyard micro-adventure, I start thinking about my next adventure. I'm inspired by the people and their stories to go a little farther and dig a little deeper. If you want to add more spark to your adventurous ideas, consider subscribing to the Diaries Plus today. I'm Crystal, a longtime listener from the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina.
Thanks to everyone who has subscribed to the Diaries Plus. It's been awesome, and you're powering the show as we move into the future. If you're interested in subscribing today, there's a link in the show notes. Please join. Now, on to the show.
At 27 years old, I was evicted from my Seattle apartment because the property was sold to developers. Trying to take the eviction as an opportunity, I sold 90% of my belongings and hoped to fulfill my long-held dream of buying a sailboat to live on. I'd been working on other people's boats my entire adult life, first in the Navy and then as a detailer on wealthy people's yachts. I wanted to set out on my own and become my own captain. The search for a boat that I could afford wasn't easy. After a few dead ends, a 27-foot boat with no name piqued my interest. It needed work, but for a 1975 Catalina sailboat, it was in fantastic shape. My boatyard boss, Jim, who taught me everything I knew about sailboats, came with me to the survey. He said it was unlikely that I'd find anything better with my budget. The boat was a donation to a nonprofit, so they were quick to make a deal. With all the cash I had in the bank, I wrote a check, signed the papers, and Jim and I motored away. It was surprisingly simple. We made our way through Lake Union's Ship Canal toward the Ballard Locks. As the waters of the canal receded in luminous green and blue whirlpools, the foaming mouths of the lock's verdigris-covered gates opened. The lines were released, and we entered the Salish Sea. Eagerly, we lifted the sails, full sail and free. In that moment, the Salish Sea became my new home. We tacked northwest toward Port Madison on Bainbridge Island. The sun burned amber as it sank to rest in the bed of Olympic Peaks. As the wind fell to slumber, cirrus clouds reflected their sunset shades in the waters below. As we floated in those fiery colors, a plop grabbed my attention. To port, another plop. And soon, plops on all sides. A chorus of plops as a rainstorm of minnows jumping out and back into the vibrant orange liquid. A massive pod of dorsal fins surrounded us. The porpoises breached, and the minnows rushed to dive and survive. Soon, the hunters had their fill, and the minnows returned to their swimming as the sun fell behind the mountains. I remembered how the dolphins of the Pacific Ocean would greet my Navy ship offshore and guide us into ports during deployments. They remembered me for this homecoming, as we lowered the sails and motored toward the marina. For the first time in my life, I felt completely independent. I had joined the Navy as a sophomore in high school in search of adventure. During my four-year enlistment, I was part of a crew. My job was gunner's mate, and I was tasked with teaching the sailors how to shoot small arms, along with being the technician on the ship's cannon. But that day, I became a captain. From there on out, I would sail solo. Many people buy a sailboat to voyage across the ocean, but that boat would be my home for my next big adventure, becoming a firefighter, something I'd been working towards since college. I became a certified emergency medical technician and applied for fire jobs around the state of Washington. In serendipitous timing, within weeks of buying the sailboat, Vashon Island Fire and Rescue offered me a chance to become a volunteer firefighter. All the hard work was beginning to pay off. My big question at the start of my life as a volunteer firefighter was whether it was safe for me to be an openly gay man in the fire industry. As a child, I'd been taught that being gay was an abomination. I moved through the world with self-loathing, my tall frame lowered into a posture of submissiveness. On the first naval ship that I lived on, I had to fit myself into other small boxes. I was lucky enough to get to the top rack in a narrow alley that consisted of bunk beds stacked three high. I would lay awake at night, listening to the 59 snoring men and waves crashing against the hull. I knew I wasn't safe. I'd come out as gay under the don't ask, don't tell policy, and my days were numbered. The weight of that injustice was written into my body. The hunched forward posture I had grown up with was now weighed down by the very real danger I found myself in. The doctrine I had been taught as a child, that there was no place for people like me, was now proven, written into law, and threatened my present and my future. I carried that posture as a new volunteer, walking around with deference, lowering myself as I had learned to do in attempts to blend in. I became aware of the thoughts that preceded the pain in my shoulders, realizing that when I entered the firehouse, this posture was exaggerated. The rigging of my body had been hunched forward for decades, bowing to the pressures placed upon me. This was my body talking to me. As I sailed in my off hours, I began to observe how my posture had carried over into my relationship with the boat. My boat's interior resembled a submarine that tapered into points at both ends. Since I'm 6'3" tall, I was barely big enough to fit inside the cabin below. The only place I could stand up straight was in the entryway. When I stood at the sink to do dishes, I had to squat down, and when I climbed into the V-berth to go to sleep, I had to squeeze myself into a 3-foot by 3-foot opening to crawl into bed. But when I was sailing above decks, I felt for the first time what it was like to stand tall. Inside the small cabin, I had a print of my favorite painting, The Ship by Salvador Dali. A surrealist image of a person who was tied to and seemed crucified by a sailing ship. It was attached to their back with nearly 2 dozen sails, and this ship person merged into the crashing waves behind them. A friend had shared it with me when we were teenagers, and it stuck. When I lived ashore, I had a poster-sized print that I'd spent years staring at, deep into the complexities of a body that was half human and half ship, a body that rode the line between two worlds and was nearly lost to both. Now, on my own ship, the painting took on a whole new meaning. The more I learned how to take care of the vessel, the more I understood that I needed to take care of myself. While I had a basic understanding of how to sail, learned from spending time on my boss Jim's boat, I had thought it was a simple affair. While I could operate the boat in smooth winds, it soon became apparent that I had a lot to learn if I wanted to keep the boat afloat during less favorable conditions. Every model of boat has its own differences, and once I learned the unique characteristics of my model, I began to build a relationship with the world around me. I measured the responses that the boat had to different winds, the way it lurched or smoothly settled. I noticed when the boat felt sturdy and when it felt like it was about to capsize. As I fine-tuned my sailing skills over the years that I lived on that boat, the lines in my hands began to feel like appendages of my own body. Much like Dali's painting, the longer I sailed, the more the boat became a part of me. and with it, the more that I understood my part in the natural environment. The more balanced my relationship with the boat, the better I moved through the sea. I learned the differences between the 5 points of sail. Close-hauled, my favorite point, meant the boat pointed into the wind and turned just off of it. With the wind in my face, the noise of the apparent wind that the boat and sails created was more than the actual speed of the wind itself. It added to the sense that I was flying. I cruised through a moderate breeze, the boat's tight sails holding the force with ease. Two years after I moved onto the boat, I got hired by the Seattle Fire Department. The elation of that dream come true was stained by the fear I carried of whether I could be openly myself. I had quietly managed to live as an openly gay volunteer firefighter, and while I had met other queer firefighters while I was there, most of them were women, not men. I anticipated my next chapter as sailing through rough water. What would happen when I walked into a fire station as a probationary firefighter and was open about who I was? While I was afraid to face that reality, I decided to be myself no matter what came my way. That decision gave me direction, but I still had a lot of water to sail through in order to get comfortable with my place in the world. It took constant attention to the wisdom of my body, constant adjustment and care. I was in unexplored territory, and every swell I sailed over felt profound. Every wind, a headwind, blinding my eyes, as if the seas of my life threatened to sink me if I made one mistake. But I tacked into the wind anyway, because on the horizon I saw the light of a dream within my reach. Living on a boat meant taking ownership of all of my needs, especially during firefighter drill school. It took me years to learn how to stand up straight in the world, to understand the role that self-talk has on my body. When experiences from my past arise, instead of receding into the hull of my boat, I now stand outside, at the helm. I lift the sails and trim them toward a better direction. If it weren't for living on that boat, I never could have stood tall as I took the firefighter's oath, the first openly gay fireman in the department to do so. When the fire chief asked us to choose someone from the crowd to pin our firefighter's badge, I pointed to my boyfriend and asked him to come up in front of the whole department and be visibly open to everyone there. My time on the boat gave me the tools I needed to unfurl and unknot the rigging of my trauma so that I could become the man I am today, a human capable of withstanding the storms of life, back straight and head held high, able to use the winds to fill the sails and voyage into uncharted territory.
I'm Lance Garland, and this is my short.
After the break, we're heading east to the Appalachian Trail for another short. Support for the Diaries comes from Ketone IQ. As I've been getting more and more into longer runs and bike rides, I found myself fighting with my mind. As the miles extend, I feel like my reactions get slower and I make more mistakes, like tripping or falling or just kind of feeling slightly out of sync descending on the bike. On those big days, I've been using Ketone IQ to help my brain keep fueled and sharp. I want to have fun, not bonk. Here's the science. Ketones already exist in your body. When you push up against your boundaries, your body begins to convert stored fat into ketones, which your brain prefers consuming. With Ketone IQ, I feed my brain so my muscles can use the glucose I get from whatever else I eat on the trail. Riders of the Tour de France have been taking the same approach. I am definitely not as fast, but I can apply the same thinking. Give it a try. You save 30% off your first subscription order at ketone.com/dirtbagdiaries. Once again, that's ketone.com/dirtbagdiaries. The link is in the show notes. Please check it out.
Approaching my 50th birthday, I was cataloging my life experiences. I grew up in upstate New York with the Adirondacks as our backyard. From early childhood, my father took me camping, hiking, and fishing, and I lived for those trips into the outdoors. Well into my teens, I was still willing to drop everything and join my dad on an adventure. I loved the gear, the maps, the dirt roads, and the special food we always got. My first husband and I shared similar upbringings, and so we paddled and camped together, eventually introducing our son into the outdoors, even as an infant. Later, after I remarried, my second husband and I took the outdoors to the next level. We were delivered by float plane to the start of a canoe trip. We hiked into the desert with only a map and compass, and we kayaked from island to island through a remote Canadian archipelago. Now, many years later, I reflected on the fact that I had never done a solo trip. Looking for a big challenge, I decided to herald my half-century mark with some time by myself in the outdoors. I really wanted to be out of my comfort zone, a little scared, and maybe forced to make a decision under a small amount of stress. My experience of aging has come with a more frequent contemplation of mortality. I was approaching what many might call over the hill, or on the other side of risk and excitement. I just wanted to know that I could still handle a little heat. I chose a backpacking trip on part of the Appalachian Trail that runs through Vermont. The plan was for my husband, Bob, to drop me and our dog, Wallace, off, and 4 days later, I would get picked up by my brother farther down the trail. On paper, the only thing different about preparing for this trip was less food, less gear, and less conversation. But without a partner to help troubleshoot situations, I worried about getting injured or lost. Honestly, I worried about the story in the paper reading, "Body of Missing Hiker Found." I worried about being in a shelter with young people who might judge me, pity me, or even think I was old and weak. The day Bob dropped me off, I hoisted my way too heavy pack and kissed him goodbye. I took my first steps onto the well-worn trail. The rutted path was more like a ditch than a trail. It went uphill, and my spirits plummeted. I started crying as weeks of anticipation and self-doubt came crashing over me. I sped up to outrun the flood, but my tears, combined with my elevated heart rate and ridiculously heavy pack, only set me on the path to hyperventilation. Images of worst-case scenarios ran through my head. I stopped in the trail and said out loud, "Eileen, get a grip." My dog impatiently ran ahead as I gulped back tears and looked around at the lovely day. I knew how to do all of this. Hike, camp, backpack, pump water, use my stove, set up my tent, and deal with all the toil of outdoor living. I wiped the tears, calmed down, and settled into my hike. A few hours in, I ran into a group of 20-something thru-hikers as I approached the summit of Stratton Mountain. I was charmed by their chatter and their friendly greetings. They all wore no-frills gear and carried an authentic vibrance and optimism. It was a gorgeous day, and they were taking turns climbing the summit fire tower to take in the view. Of course, I wanted to try, but I have to admit I was a little nervous. I set off with Wallace up the stairs. Now, Wallace was the epitome of bold and brave, except when it came to steps or bridges that he could see through. He dug his little claws into the wooden steps, flattened himself out, and started to shiver. The thru-hikers cheerfully offered to hold him while I went up and took in the quintessential Vermont view. The vista of mountains, lush and velvety with their green summer foliage against the bright blue sky, was calming and worth the scary climb up the swaying fire tower. As I began hiking toward that evening's shelter, they passed me again, breezily patting Wallace and sending me heartfelt hellos. We all shared a large lean-to that night in a space filled with bunks and a big loft. To my surprise, I found that I had cell service. While I was glad to reach out and connect with Bob, it was not exactly the solitude I had been seeking. But on my first night, I was grateful for the security of a crowd and the reassurance of my husband's messages. The next day, I set off through a more remote section of the trail. Birch trees cast their green-yellow glow, and the lack of underbrush made the woods bright and beautiful. The dark trail was smooth and even. I found my rhythm and I was feeling good. Eventually, the sound of high female voices cut through the rustle of the leaves, and as I took a break, a group of girls and their trip leaders stopped to enjoy some warm sun and a snack. Wallace couldn't get enough of the kind of adoration that only a middle school-aged girl can give. I learned that they were Girl Scouts and on the same route as me. Throughout the rest of the day, we leapfrogged each other before finally ending up at the same shelter for the night. I found myself charmed by these girls and how thrilled they were to be in the woods. The hard work, cold air, and lack of flush toilets did not bother them, and I admired their strength. The thru-hikers were there, too, that night. As I set up camp, the thru-hikers would come in and introduce themselves by their trail names. I had never heard of this tradition before, and I found it to be a little silly. Shark, Astro, Cosmic Orangutan, Whizzer. The names seemed childish and affected. Even their dog had a trail name, and I was not buying in. The next day, I had hiked for a few hours when it started to rain. It was the kind of rain that is steady, fills your boots, and makes you either access your hardcore hiker or set up your tent in the closest clearing and open a good book. My strategy was to get somewhere with a roof regardless of the rain, so Wallace and I soldiered on to the next shelter. I was soaked to the skin when I arrived at a brand new oversized shelter to find it packed with young hikers and their trail names. I found a seat on the bench and took off my pack. The hikers happily made space, but I was chilly and needed to change. I boosted Wallace and my pack up into the loft. Sitting in my wet clothes until darkness was not a realistic plan. I was going to have to change, even though these kids would see my aging body and excess fat. There were two guys in the loft setting up their space, and I said, unless you don't want to be in therapy when you get older, I suggest you look away. I'm going to take off my clothes. They laughed and gave me privacy. Dry and comfortable in the loft, I listened to the chatter below as rain pattered on the roof. The thru-hikers were thinking of pushing on to a spot on the mountain a few miles away. A few minutes later, another group of hikers arrived and reported a group of Girl Scouts en route to the shelter for the night. In an amazingly smooth and swift exodus, all but two or three thru-hikers dissolved into the rainy afternoon. I'll admit I was glad. Around the Girl Scouts, I felt like myself, a protector, a caregiver, and someone who can relate to young people. To the thru-hikers, I felt like a buzzkill. Just before dusk, two more hikers came in and set up next to me in the loft. I chatted with one of the 20-something men for a few minutes before asking his name. It's Rocket Man. He hesitated, and I saw him shift a little in a sleeping bag. My real name is Mark. My mom hates my trail name. We laughed together and continued chatting about insignificant things until we slept. My last day of hiking was anticlimactic. I had had continuous cell service, so I didn't feel cut off from my husband. I shared the trail with the inspiring Girl Scouts. I saw Rocket Man, Shark, and Cosmic Orangutan too. And while still a little judgmental of the trail names, enjoyed their pleasant energy. As I hiked along, I was feeling a little like an imposter. The trip had been physically hard, but mentally, I wasn't challenged. I had easily found water, shelter, and warmth every night. I was able to check Facebook and text my husband. I was around humans all the time. As the trail sloped downhill, it seemed like a metaphor for the whole trip. Easy, culminating in a relaxed finish. I wasn't sure I could really be that proud of it. I reached the parking lot where the Girl Scouts were already awaiting their van. I dropped my pack and sat down with Wallace. They came over and gave him more pets and cuddles. I leaned against a rock and closed my eyes, overhearing some quiet conversation. "Hi," said one of the girls. "We wanted to let you know that we decided on a trail name for you." I looked up with interest. "A trail name? For me?" "It's Daisy. It's because you are pretty and nice, and we think a flower is a good name for you." I had set out on this trip to be a backcountry goddess, to prove that I was tough and thick-skinned. I wanted to access a version of myself that I hadn't known before and project that to the world. But these girls saw me as safe, approachable, and nice. Nice was not how I wanted to see myself after this experience. I wanted to be hard, edgy, and rugged. And yet, despite my disdain for the tradition, I found myself with a trail name. I had set out to uncover something new in me. Instead, I found that no matter what I did, the person I am prevails. A backpacking trip couldn't reveal something I'm not. It could only help me see that who I am is always going to shine through. My name is Daisy, also known as Eileen Hall, and this is my short.
Thank you, Lance and Eileen, for sharing your stories. Our stories come from friends of friends, and from you, our community. If you have a compelling idea for a guest or a story lead, please give us a shout. You can use the submission form on our website, dirtbagdiaries.com. Music today from Jesse Sevenberg, Faring, Padelm, Tigers in the Sky, JV and the Super Molten, David Swenson, and Joya. The tracks are courtesy of the artists or track club. Jacob Bain and Nice Cotto composed our theme song. You can find the links to the artists on our website, dirtbagdiaries.com. This episode was produced by Lauren Delaney Miller with additional production help from Ashley Langholz and Becca Cahal. Artwork by Walker Cahal. Becca Cahal is our executive producer. I'm Fitz, and you're listening to the Dirtbag Diaries. Thanks for tuning in.